My name is Harry Griff. I, number 12040, and it's been my privilege in this divorce proceeding to be representing the wife. Very briefly, as background, this is a woman who essentially followed her husband to remote areas of Wyoming while he was working in the oil fields. She raised three beautiful kids, and towards the latter part of their marriage, her husband could literally sniff the money that was flowing through western Colorado. And he took the knowledge that he had learned while he was working out in the fields. He has a high school education. He formed a company called NRG Services, and it's a well services company. He relocated to western Colorado. His wife stayed behind in Wyoming to raise their third child through high school. He didn't want to switch high schools in midstream. And a couple of, and then when the youngest son graduated high school, she rejoined her husband in Grand Junction. A couple of years later, he decided he wanted to get divorced. Right at the cusp of him making a ton of money, $1 million a year. How many times have we seen that fact pattern? He clearly has the right to get divorced, and my client has the right to be treated fairly in the process, as do everyone who is similarly situated to her. And that leads us to the two issues that are involved in, on this cert. The first is whether you should extend the holding in Pueblo Bancorp that prohibits the application of a marketability discount to the valuation of a company. It's ongoing, and there is no evidence that it's in the process of being sold. And what's interesting here is all of the analysis of the marketability discount was done in the Pueblo Bancorp decision. So we're not operating in a vacuum here. This court has already addressed the concerns with the marketability discount. The issue is whether it should be extended from the context of a minority shareholder dispute to the context of a divorce proceeding. And it clearly should be. One thing, as articulated in Pueblo, the marketability discount is a completely speculative discount. At this point in time...
Now, what's the policy reason for that?
For
a discount?
The policy reason for the discount, from an accounting standpoint, I mean, what a marketability discount is it's saying because this is a closely held company, it's not as liquid as trading stock. So there, when you're looking at it, there may be reasons to discount the value of the business because of its illiquidity. You're also going, well, if and when we go to sell the business, what costs might be associated with the sale of the business? But that's all speculative, because right now no one has any idea what the husband in this case will do with his interests.
Mr. Griff, could I back you up just a moment? In the evaluation process, before you get to whether to take a marketability discount, isn't it inherent in the evaluation that a market is assumed? I mean, in the process of understanding what the value is, it's the sense of value assumes the possibility of an exchange or sale.
Exactly. And, well, and if I'm following your question correctly, the Brown decision that was cited in the briefing, there are two main concerns with the marketability discount. One is it's completely speculative. The second is that it double counts those factors that go into the construction of the cap rate. And that's exactly what happened in Brown. That's exactly what happened in our case. The accountant in our case, husband's accountant, included concerns about the management, the closely held corp, the customer base, in his construction of the cap rate, and then he used those exact same concerns again in applying a 33% marketability discount. He reduced husband's value in the company from $2.5 million to $1.6 million.
Mr. Griff, to the extent that is true, isn't that more of sort of a case-by-case look at how the evaluation was conducted? And then if there's a marketability discount taken, trying to consider whether it's duplicating something that was already considered in the first part of the evaluation? Isn't that more a matter of fact, case-by-case to be determined, than a legal principle that you can or cannot take a marketability discount?
Well, that issue was directly addressed in Pueblo Bancorp. And what the court said in Pueblo Bancorp is that in cases like this, where you give judges so much discretion, the reality is there's no rule at all. They have too much discretion. And for the same reasons that the court in Pueblo Bancorp felt that it was necessary to have a black letter rule in the context of a minority shareholder dispute, you can't apply a marketability discount in that context. The exact same rationale applies here in the context of a divorce proceeding. And the same public interests are impacted if you were to apply or extend that rule here. Right now, when you go into court and you're arguing a case like this, you have no idea whether the judge is going to apply a marketability discount or not. And if he or she does, whether the marketability discount is going to be anywhere from 1% to 35%. It makes it impossible to settle cases. It makes it impossible to value cases. And
so under the marital law, what would the spouse be entitled to?
The spouse would be entitled to have the non-owner spouse would be entitled to have the corporation valued as a going concern. And then with the spouse's fractional ownership interest, multiplied by the spouse's fractional ownership interest in that company, without application of a subsequent marketability discount. And the fairness of that doctrine was articulated in Pueblo. Every issue associated with it was articulated in Pueblo. The only question is whether it should be extended to a divorce proceeding. Both experts in this case acknowledged that it should be. Both experts acknowledged that there was no rational basis for distinguishing the spouse in a divorce proceeding from the minority stockholder in a shareholder dispute. The only distinction that husband's accountant could come up with at trial was to say, well, in Pueblo, they talked about applying the multiplication at the quote-unquote shareholder level. He applied it at the quote-unquote corporate level. Well, mathematically, that's a distinction without merit. 5 times 4 times 2 is equal to 5 times 2.4. It's a completely non-meritorious distinction, and that's all he could come up with.
Now, how does a judge determine the non-owner spouse's percentage of ownership in the closely held business?
That's evidenced by their memberships in the company and or by their stock ownership. I mean, that's a given. In this case, it was stipulated husband owns 70.5% of the business, so the value of the company as an ongoing entity was multiplied by 70.5. That was a non-issue, and it'll be a non-issue in every case.
So I wanted to follow up, if you're finished, with the question about the record. So each side had an expert witness.
Yes.
And each side valued this NRG services without respect to any kind of a discount.
Initially.
Okay, and then the judge or someone said, what happened then? No, you have to discount it or what?
Well, what happened is that in the case of the husband's valuation, he applied in his expert report a marketability discount. In the wife's expert's valuation, he explained why he did not think a marketability discount was appropriate based upon the rationale of Pueblo Bancorp. Wife, in this case, signed a separation agreement that was ultimately adopted by the, upheld by the trial court. So, and that separation agreement was based upon husband's accountant's valuation before wife had ever retained counsel. Since it was based upon husband's accountant's valuation, it incorporated by reference that discounted value. The judge never addressed the issue of the propriety of the discount at trial, all the, or in his permanent orders, all the judge did was uphold the separation agreement, which was tossed on appeal and which is not at issue.
So did the judge make any findings about whether or not Pueblo should be extended or not?
None. Didn't address.
The judge just took husband's valuation of NRG Services, which was a third less because of this discount.
That's correct, without any addressment of the fairness of that valuation at all.
Okay. So then the Court of Appeals comes along and basically affirms that.
What the appellate court did was tossed the separation agreement. So ultimately, this case is getting remanded back to NOVO.
Right. So would it therefore, I beg your pardon, would it therefore make sense for us to let the trial court on remand to try to make this decision based upon expert testimony? Or do you perceive this as only a legal question, as pure and simply a legal question, that is whether the discount should be applied or not?
I view it as a legal question. And the reason for that is a couple-fold.
Please.
Primary reason is this was really addressed in Pueblo. And as a matter of law, for all of the reasons articulated in Pueblo, there should be a black letter rule here that takes away from the trial court the discretion to apply the discount. If you allow this to be on a case-by-case basis, you are then back to the dicta in Pueblo that flat out said that's essentially having no rule. And having no rule is giving the trial court too much discretion. So for that reason, I view this as a matter of law. I think the question here is whether the holding in Pueblo should be extended. We do not want to be in a case-by-case situation because that's where we are right now. The reality is that is the ground upon which we are operating right now.
Mr. Griff, can I follow up on that and ask you, do you think this is, you talk about extending Pueblo, is this our choice as a policy matter, or are we construing what the legislature has required in terms of separation?
Well, again, that was addressed in Pueblo and also in the New Jersey case of Brown versus Brown.
The same statute that we were addressing in Pueblo?
I'm sorry?
Are we addressing the same statute that we were addressing?
No, there's a statute that was involved in Pueblo that uses the term fair value in the context of a minority shareholder dispute. Remarkably, in the divorce context, 1410.113 doesn't say anything about how you value a company. All it talks in terms of is you define what is the marital estate versus the separate estate, and then you equitably allocate the marital estate. The courts have had a dialogue with the legislature for 50 years in this state regarding the fleshing out of that statute. You have clarified how you value companies. With respect to goodwill, you've ratified the excess earnings methodology for valuing companies. You've addressed how you value retirement plans. You have addressed whether you take taxation into account in resolving divorce disputes. All of that has been because of the ambiguity in our statute. If the legislature doesn't like what you've said, the legislature has the right to address that. That's exactly the comment you made in Pueblo Bancorp in the context of a minority dispute. Pueblo discusses the Brown case, it discusses that exact same point, and used as its lever, if you will, the fact that in the divorce statute, it talks in terms of an equitable allocation of the estate. And all of those cases are fleshing out the ambiguity of what is meant by equitable. And just as in Pueblo, we're saying in this case, equitable means you can't apply a marketability discount to the valuation of a court. It's just unfair. it's speculative, it's double counting, and it's unfair to the non-owner.
You're saying that the use of a marketability discount vitiates the concept of fair value?
I'm not sure. You know, the terms of fair value, fair market value, from my perspective, are juxtaposed in the real world. In our case, amazingly, the husband's expert talked in terms of fair value, which is you're not supposed to apply the discount, but he did. Wife's expert talked in terms of fair market value. You're not supposed, you can apply the discount, but he did not. Cutting through all that smoke, at the end of the day, both experts valued the company as going concerns. They established their cap rate, and they came within $30,000 of one another in valuing a $3.6 million company. That's amazing. The only difference between the valuations was the marketability discount.
Do you think that language of equitable allocation suggests any greater discretion and reliance on the circumstances of each case than would be true in the minority shareholder statute?
I don't, not on this particular issue. And let me, and the last point I'd like to make on this issue, because there's one other, unless, you know, I'll defer to your questions, obviously, but why should... let's assume that a wife in a particular case or a spouse in a particular case, because today's day and age, the woman could own this company. But why should it matter in terms of valuing this company for the divorce purpose whether the other spouse has any stock interest or not in the company? You know, there are times when one of the partners in the divorce will say, you know, honey, I love you so much. I want you to have a piece of this company. Here's 5%. Or perhaps the other spouse has worked in the company as providing clerical or bookkeeping or some non-management, and they get some stock associated with that. They would be better off right now under the Pueblo context than they would be in the context of getting divorced, and that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
You're kind of leaning into one thing I was thinking about here. So if they didn't divide up this asset, if she just now has whatever it was, 35% roughly, of the shares in the corporation, and they could go on from there, she would be in the same position, wouldn't she, as the minority shareholder?
Well, she has no stock ownership at the moment. If they had resolved the divorce by way
that's
of...
That's what I'm saying.
She would be. That's exactly
if
right.
If you did that, rather than require, I guess, in this instance, the husband to cash out the wife, just say, okay, you got 35% of this company, then what would happen?
Well,
could be a proceeding under the minority.
Yes, and that's, I'd like two things about that. The first is the case law is that's not the way the divorces get resolved.
Sure.
You want them to separate sheets. But that's exactly my point, which is recognizing that, why should the rule in the divorce context be different than the rule in the minority shareholder context? That's where the distinction falls apart.
And are you about to argue, however, that with regard to maintenance, the trial court should have greater discretion and take into account the circumstances of individual cases?
Well, but within the parameters of the statute, and thank you for the segue. The second issue in this case is the temporary orders maintenance issue. And it is black letter law now in Colorado that the maintenance statute is flexible. The reasonable needs of the spouse, and whether the spouse can meet those reasonable needs through appropriate employment, depend upon the circumstances of each case. Reasonable needs is based upon the standard of living during the marriage, and whether the spouse is engaged in appropriate employment depends upon that spouse's employment background. In this particular case, the appellate court essentially ruled that because my client is now an occupational therapist and earns in the neighborhood of $45,000 a year, and can meet her quote-unquote reasonable needs. She was not entitled to any temporary spousal maintenance, even though her husband is now earning in excess of $1 million, over $80,000 a month. That, if you take that to its logical conclusion, that means that no one who has a job that earns a moderate amount of income in the state of Colorado would ever be entitled to an award of maintenance, irregardless of how much money her spouse makes. That is simply not the law. Under the temporary orders maintenance statute, there's a distinction between couples that earn less than $75,000 combined, there's a formula to address that, and those who earn more than $75,000 a year combined, which is technically supposed to be the same analysis that's applied to permanent orders maintenance. There are two reasons why an award of maintenance in the temporary orders context is even more compelling. One is that you're bollocksing up attorney's fees with that maintenance award. It's not just a question of meeting your reasonable needs during the pendency of the divorce. Oftentimes, the magistrate is cash flowing your attorney's fees through that award. That doesn't apply in permanent orders. The second is that income earned during the marriage is marital property subject to division. Income earned after you're divorced is an economic circumstance applicable to the issue of maintenance. But why, as in a case like this, should one spouse who's making all that money be able to keep that money during the pendency of the divorce without the other spouse having the right to share in a reasonable, as determined by the magistrate, a reasonable amount of that money, which is really property as it's coming in?
Can I just stop you there, and then you can go to your third point, but I see your time is fleeting by. So can you address, though, perhaps your problem, I believe she'll stand up and say this, is that you have a magistrate's statement that your client was not unable to find appropriate employment, or I'm not sure exactly what the statement is, but it basically takes you out or mimics the language in the statute and takes you out of that. Can you address that directly?
Yeah.
The magistrate statement, I think it comes in two different places in the record.
The magistrate at that hearing was speaking from the bench. And she said, on the one hand, I recognize that the wife has a good job that is now paying a reasonable amount of money, and yes, she can technically meet her basic needs. No question, she said that. But then in the next breath, she said, but I cannot overlook the fact that husband is now making in excess of $1 million a year, and the case law mandates that I address the issue of maintenance based upon the standard of living at the time of this hearing. And she then went on to say, based upon the elasticity of the two prongs of the maintenance formula, that wife was nevertheless entitled to continue to enjoy a semblance of the lifestyle that husband's business was now generating during the pendency of the divorce. She also made clear that she was not awarding attorney's fees, temporary attorney's fees, because she was giving wife enough temporary maintenance to cash flow not only her needs, but the costs of the dissolution. I think that you're taking a sentence that, she certainly said it, but you're taking it out of context and you're giving it a life that it really doesn't deserve.
Okay, then let me follow up on that. Do you think that essentially that is unable to support himself or herself through appropriate employment? You're saying that isn't a prerequisite to giving maintenance or temporary maintenance? Isn't that kind of a showing that gets you into the maintenance world, so to speak? I guess you reject that, but I'm trying to figure out why, under the statutory language.
Well, again, because OLAR, and other cases have made clear that when you are determining whether someone meets the threshold eligibility for maintenance, the issue is whether through their appropriate employment, in this case, my client's income as an occupational therapist, she can earn enough money to meet her reasonable needs based upon the standard of living that was established during the course of the marriage. For the last 5 years of this marriage, that standard of living was over $1 million a year. So the answer to the question is no, she can't meet her quote-unquote reasonable needs based upon her reasonable employment when you match that up against the standard of living established in this marriage. If that threshold isn't met, then you don't get to the question of, well, okay, how much? But if you determine that that threshold has been met, which is really the first prong of the test, if that threshold has been met, then you get to, okay, how much? For permanent orders, you get to, okay, how much and how long?
Well, I'm looking at the judge's order, and it seems she made a lot of findings with respect to the husband's affidavit, but almost nothing with respect to the wife's, unless I'm not looking at the correct thing. Did the magistrate at any point say, you know, she has $7,000 or $8,000 worth a month?
Yeah, we provided a very detailed, quite accurate, actually, affidavit to the trial.
Is that in the record someplace, what those needs are?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And let me also, and that's my final point here, because I think it's important that you keep in mind that you're not the appellate court here, and you're not the trial court here. You took this issue up on cert, and there's a process here. And this is my final point on this issue. The process with respect to temporary orders is, A, it's heard by the magistrate. The party that is unhappy with those orders has the right to request district court review. Mr. Thornhill did that in this case. There's no 60-day deadline associated with that motion. The trial court has the right to defer resolution of that request for district court review until final orders, and that's what happened here. And this is the one area of the district court judge's decision where he actually spoke at length. And he had the opportunity to look back as of the date of final orders during the entire temporary orders period to see how it worked during that period. And what we established at trial was that notwithstanding the magnitude of the temporary orders maintenance awarded to my client, husband did just fine. Husband bought a new house. He put $90,000 down. He bought a sports car for $40,000. He accelerated payments on his mortgage. He accelerated payments on a furniture loan. He was able to fully finance his company without missing a beat. The judge looked at all of that and said, okay, I am affirming the magistrate's temporary orders maintenance award. It goes up now to the appellate court. Husband appealed that to the appellate court. Well, the appellate court is supposed to defer to decisions of the district court judge that are A, supported by the evidence, and B, within the exercise of the district court judge's discretion. Clearly, in this case, the appellate court should have affirmed the district court judge's affirmance of the magistrate's temporary orders. It was clearly within the ambit of the judge's discretion, and it was clearly supported by the evidence adduced not only at temporary orders, but also at final orders. The appellate court was completely off base in overturning that award. I honestly don't know what the appellate court was thinking when it did it, because it was so inconsistent with the established process. When you are now looking at this, I believe that's how you have to look. You have to take a step back and go, whether the appellate court deviated from its process in overturning the district court judge's affirmance of the magistrate's order, because it really was not de novo. It was bound by the judge's decision, assuming the judge's decision was within the ambit of its authority, as it was. Any other questions? Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Vicki Allison, attorney registration number 11693, on behalf of Appley Husband. First, with regard to the issue of the Pueblo Bank. Pueblo Bank ruling was made by this court based upon the dissenters' rights statute. 7113-101 to 302. The dissenters' rights is essentially a fair value case. The standard to determine value is different when you are making a fair value determination than when you are making a fair market value determination. Pueblo Bank said that there should be no discount at the shareholder level. Fair value was basically defined as the proportionate share of the shareholder at the time immediately before the corporate action dissented against. Thornhill and the dissolution of marriage cases are based upon 1410-113. The court shall, without respect to marital fault or misconduct, divide marital property as it deems just after review of all relevant factors and circumstances. There's no mention of fair value in the domestic relations arena.
But the entirety of domestic relationships is based upon a fair apportionment of assets.
Yes,
and fair and equitable is the entire concept behind domestic relationships.
That is correct.
So if the valuation isn't fair to begin with, then everything else is not fair as well, is it?
That is a correct statement. With regard to the issue of valuing this particular corporation, NRG, basically what the court did in adopting Husband's expert opinion was to adopt a marketability discount at the entity level. Husband's expert, along with wife's expert, calculated their capitalization rate. And then Husband's expert, using basically the marketability discount. Now, the capitalization rate is based upon the Ibotsam buildup method and essentially starts from a safe rate of return. It adds a slight bit of risk for the equity premium that is equal to what we find in the stock market. It adds an additional bit of risk for what buyers would demand in purchasing a publicly held small company. And then lastly, under the capitalization rate, you do consider what amount of risk for the particular company at issue. And this is where the argument can come in that there might be double counting. Under the capitalization rate, you do look at the size of the company, you look at the proprietary content of the goods and services, is there a patent, market strength, factors like that. The marketability discount here is based upon a series of studies that values and compares the subject company, NRG, to restricted stock studies from 1966 to 2000 on the John D. Emery pre-initial public offering studies, 1975 to 2000, and the Mandelbaum factors. The Mandelbaum Tax Commission case was provided to the court in the additional authorities. That includes public versus private sales, financial analysis, distributions, historical data. So it is not double counting. They are two different factors. The expert for husbands started with a 35% discount. The pre-IPO studies indicated a discount in the range of 45 to 50%. The restricted stock studies indicated a 33.16% discount. We're dealing with a closely held private corporation that is just that. It is private. You cannot take a share of a private company, go to your stockbroker, have it sold, get your money tomorrow, and move on, such as you can in a public company. Husband's expert did use the fair market value approach. That is why there is a marketability discount. Pueblo Bank indicated that under a fair market standard, that a marketability discount should be used. And it does not distort the fair and equitable distribution to apply a marketability discount. The marketability discount assesses this company, this private closely held company, against the universe of investments. Basically, a buyer willing to tie up his or her money in an illiquid asset is going to want a premium in the form of a lower price. A fair value looks more at the value of the share in terms of corporate proportion. The marketability discount performs the function of balancing the risk versus the reward. The one consistent fact in this case, from the time the parties began working on their own separation agreement in September of 05, was that wife was wanting cash for her interest, for her half interest in the husband's NRG. The parties, through the assistance of wife's father, who was the CFO for NRG, set up a spreadsheet to try and help the parties divide half and half all of their assets. And basically, NRG was valued by husband's expert with a discount, looking at the company as it was worth to a third party, not as it is worth to the member. That is a different standard, a different premise of value. And your fair market value is your willing buyer and your willing seller. Husband had been the majority shareholder. He wanted to stay in that position. So you have a willing seller and a willing buyer. Wife had other options. Husband, unlike the Brown case from New Jersey that Pueblo cited, wife had other options. Her two sons are shareholders in NRG. There was a one non-family member, Troy Malone, who was a key man. He was responsible for working with the largest company who brought in millions each year, approximately 60% of NRG's income. She had several options to market her share.
But could you explain what that means? What were her options?
if she didn't get cash, what?
Wife's option, she could have kept her share in NRG and been an equal shareholder.
I'm not understanding. Did she actually own shares in NRG?
She did not own share. Her husband was the share owner.
That's what I thought. So she was given the option of actually taking the shares.
She had that as an option.
Was that formally presented or?
The operating agreement was there and available. She was aware of it, but that was not her choice.
I'm confused why we're going into this great detail, because the separation agreement was set aside, right?
So yes, it was set aside.
And her argument basically was, I didn't understand what I was signing, and so, and that yes, my father was advising me, but nobody was representing me. Right?
That is correct.
So the trial court's going to have to relook at this. So why is all this relevant?
The theme, the consistent theme, wife was wanting her share of NRG in the form of cash. She was that hypothetical willing buyer.
That's when she entered into the separation agreement. That's now been set aside. So,
correct.
So we're going to go back and do it over again.
But that will not change wife's position that she is going to seek, she wants liquidity.
Well, we don't know, do we?
It is not appropriate to extend Pueblo Bank and make it a fixed rule. Revenue ruling 5960, which is contained in the materials, in the CLE materials that were presented, basically indicates that valuation is a question of fact. It is not an exact science. Since valuation has to be upon all of the relevant facts and circumstances, it should also include the application of informed judgment and reasonableness. Economic change is addressed in the IRS revenue ruling. And it summed up that valuation of securities, in essence, is a prophecy of the future. A business valuation is an estimate of what it is anticipated that this company will earn in the future, typically based upon past historical data. With the economy that we are in, that is a factor that must be considered in doing these business valuations. A case which came to my awareness last week through my estate and tax, the estate of Valeria M. Miller, it's a tax court memo 2009-119. Issued May 27, 2009. Mrs. Miller, at her advanced elderly age, made two separate transfers of her property to her family limited partnership. The IRS, Miller wanted to value only one of them for estate tax purposes, and the IRS indicated that no, both parcels needed to be valued and included for estate tax purposes. In that case, the estate used a 35% discount to value Mrs. Miller's transfers to the family limited partnership. The IRS did not contest the 35% marketability discount. This cannot be a fixed rule because divorce criteria has always been what is fair and equitable. The court, in valuing tangible property, does not look at what the value of that big screen TV was when it came out of the box from the store. I can't tell you how many times over my 30-plus years, I or another counsel or the court has indicated, posed a question to a witness. Sir, I'd like to know what you would value that big screen TV at if you sold it to your friend or you put it in a garage sale. Fair market value has been the consistent, predominant, underlying valuation thread of domestic relations. Wife's cases, she cited Baltrusis. This is an unpublished Washington case. No discount was allowed. However, in that case, ex-wife was the only market husband had for his small number of shares. Here, wife had three other individuals besides husband if she were going to choose to market what would be could be allotted to her as half of NRG. Book out, the issue was goodwill. As recently as September 17, 2009, in an article, Lawyers USA Online, an article entitled Economy Creates a Nightmare for Valuation Cases. A local domestic relations attorney and author that I'm sure all of us here today are familiar with, Stephen Harhi, stated that in business valuation, the fundamental concept is the anticipation of future profits. At this point, Harhi indicates that, quote, the disruption of the economy is of such historic proportion that it has thrown a lot of fundamental assumptions underlying the valuation process into question.
What is your position about the Pueblo Bank case? Do you think that it was just wrongly decided? Or it doesn't apply here? Or some combination?
I believe that the Pueblo Bank case is a fair value case, a totally different premise of value than the fair market value premise.
How does that fit in with the idea that the court is supposed to do justice and it's come up with a just and equitable division of the property? I mean, let's assume you're right. There's a technical difference.
The level, the time and place to do justice is at the trial level when experts are available for the court for cross-examination to ferret out the actual factors that do or don't apply to a particular one business is not.
Can I just ask you a question? Are you saying basically that depending on what the wife wants or the spouse wants, for instance, in this particular case, you would apply the discount if it were just a transfer of shares rather than a buyout? Is that, in other words, not make a flat rule, but in the case where you're talking about a closely held corporation and you make the distinction between fair market value and fair value, is that what you're getting at? Is that the rule we should do?
I think that is an area that the court should look at, that there is a distinction between the premise underlying the dissenter's rights statute and the case law that supports 1410.113, where the court is only given the guideline to consider value of the property to each spouse as of the date of decree and allocate it fairly and equitably. Fairly and equitably, when you have to approach an asset, you value each asset, and I think in the divorce arena, with regard to business corporations, it is not appropriate to extend the hard and fast rule of no marketability discounts. And even if Pueblo Bank were applied, Pueblo Bank itself, along with the Brown case, indicates that there clearly are times, places, and circumstances that a marketability discount may apply. That particular issue was not before the court in Pueblo Bank, but the court did indicate they were not addressing that at that particular time. If there are no other questions, I would move on to my second issue. I do believe that the appellate court was correct in overturning the trial court's award of maintenance. I think that the trial court simply balanced the overall equities by affirming an excessive temporary maintenance award to wife and adopting the separation agreement and the value of husband's expert. The facts with regard to the Thornhill matter, husband had $14,000 a month guaranteed income. Anything beyond that was a distribution from the company. Any distribution he took was pro rata, paid out to all of the other partners. The income upon which wife chooses to rely, and the magistrate did at temporary orders, is essentially retained earnings. This is a company begun in 2001. The original partner died. Mr. Thornhill regrouped, took in his two sons and another shareholder. They're still in the growing process. So the monies that the magistrate relied upon at temporary orders never went into Mr. Thornhill's pocket or bank account. He got his $14,000 a month. She got her approximate $47,900 from her occupational therapy. Basically,
Ms. Allison, can I stop you there, though? Are you arguing that the amount, was excessive, or that the Court of Appeals was correct in its decision? I mean, what do you think about the Court of Appeals' opinion? Are you embracing it, or?
I believe that the Court of Appeals, it was proper for the Court of Appeals to overturn the trial court's ruling that the magistrate's award of maintenance was proper. The magistrate made no findings with regard to the threshold. She simply did not. She also made no findings as to the necessary, ordinary, and justifiable business expenses that Mr. Thornhill needed to pay out of the retained earnings, upon which she arbitrarily calculated his net income. So the appellate court was totally correct in overturning the trial court's embracing of that.
That's not what the appellate court did, did it? The appellate court, the Court of Appeals, seems to have latched on to these statements in the magistrate's order that essentially wife was able to, have employment, that it was suitable employment. And you're not going down that path. I'm just trying to figure that out.
I do believe wife had suitable employment. Her financial affidavit showed that she was able to meet her necessary and reasonable needs. And I do believe that the magistrate did not at all follow the statute in making an assessment as to whether wife did or did not lack sufficient property. The magistrate did not make an assessment as to whether wife had sufficient income on her own, sufficient property to meet her own needs. The magistrate merely looked at this large figure on last year's tax return and said, gosh, I can't ignore that. Wife's got to have a share. And so she made some arbitrarily calculations that are totally wrong.
Okay, so how do you think the magistrate should proceed? I mean, step number one is question, does the wife lack sufficient property? And your answer to that would be?
My answer to that would be is that the magistrate had testimony in front of her regarding the guaranteed income, wife's salary. The magistrate also had in front of her evidence that in a five-month period, husband had transferred to wife approximately $103,000. She had use of $53,000 from the sale of the prior residence to put down on her new home. She had two vehicles, one a $24,000 Volvo, paid in full. She had sufficient resources and an analysis of her income, the availability, an analysis of husband's income, the guaranteed income versus what was retained in the company for business expenses. The magistrate was in error in granting temporary maintenance. The court asked that we address the issue of what are reasonable needs, what are or what is appropriate employment. Here, wife sought her course of education. She achieved a master's degree in occupational therapy. She was working in that field, earning over $45,000 a year, and I believe that that issue is really not the issue in this case. The question is, what are reasonable needs? And a brief review of other states, Ferdinand v. Ferdinand, 215 AD 2nd, 350, 625 New York sub 2nd, 650, indicated that pendant maintenance is designed to ensure that the needy spouse is provided with funds for his or her support and reasonable needs.
When we consider, when the trial court considers reasonable needs, do they look at the standard of living particularly in this case, I guess, where they, in the last couple of years of the marriage, the standard of living seems to have jumped up quite high?
I believe they would look at the standard of living. I think that an accurate review of the standard of living, however, would show that husband had available the $14,000 a month on his part. The rest of the monies by September temporary orders hearing was already committed with liabilities, taxes, estimated taxes, equipment contracts, and the like. And the standard of living, yes, but it would take into account what is needed out of that retained earnings to keep the company viable and supported. In Reed Crowley, 663 P. 2nd, 267, a 1983 case, took the position that child support does not take precedence over business expenses. To accept such a conclusion would create a situation where you have the eventual loss of all income when the business reaches the point where it is not able to...
Did you just misspeak by saying child support?
Pardon?
Did you just misspeak by saying child support? What would child support have to do with this case?
This case simply was referencing child support, that child support does not take precedence over business expenses. With regard to in remarriage of Sim, for maintenance, determination of the payor spouse's income is only relevant to the extent that it is indicative of that spouse's ability to meet his own needs and meet those of the payee's spouse. And so the two-prong test was not overly stretched, I believe was counsel's word.
Excuse me, counsel, I think your time has expired.
Yes. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess.